Welcome to Brains Matter, the podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, just an ordinary guy. Let's get into the episode. Today's episode is a recording of a talk given by Professor Ralph Pudritz, Director of the Origins Institute at McMaster University in Canada. He gave a talk at Monash University titled, From First Stars to First Life.
Hello everybody, welcome to Monash. It's great to see so many of you here. It's my very great pleasure to introduce Professor Ralph Pudritz, who's our speaker tonight. So Ralph has been visiting his first time in Australia ever, I believe. As Ralph put it, he said he was in Japan and thought it was close by. So Ralph's been visiting us at Monash today and will be at Swinburne tomorrow, doing a sort of quick fire tour of some of the astronomy departments in the country. Ralph studies a subject particularly close to my own heart, which is star formation, but he does things a lot more exciting than that. Now, just a disclaimer, we're not going to reveal any new alien life tonight. We haven't found it. We're still looking. Just in case you came for that announcement, you can go home now. Happy. So Ralph did his PhD in 1980. Ralph is Canadian, as you'll detect very quickly from his accent. His PhD was in 1980 in Toronto, which is where he's from originally. Is that correct? Oh, no, actually, you're from some town in the middle of Canada. With no one, three inhabitants. And, yeah. Now you're here in nice warm Australia. Following his PhD, he did a postdoctoral fellowship in Cambridge, followed by a position at Johns Hopkins University in the States, and a stint at Berkeley in between in California, which is a hotbed for star formation research. He joined the faculty at McMaster in 1986, which is, how old was I at the time? About eight. and has been there ever since as a member of the faculty. Ralph is very well known in the star formation community. He's done a number of particularly interesting things, which I'm sure you'll hear a little bit about tonight. And it is obviously being one of the most prominent Canadian astronomers, is involved in all aspects of Canadian astronomy and has been involved in lots of things, allocating time for telescopes, being on advisory panels for some of the biggest things that we do in astronomy, like the Gemini telescopes and the James Webb Space Telescope. He was actually chair of Canada's sort of big decade review, so we have one in Australia where you every 10 years review what are the big things we should be doing for the next 10 years. So Ralph actually chaired the Canadian version of that. But most excitingly for us here tonight, he was the founding director of the Origins Institute, which is an institute founded to study the big questions, or as they put it, to promote origins research that helps answer fundamental questions in science, such as how and why the universe began, how did stars, planets and galaxies form, what's the origin of matter and the elements, how did life begin on Earth, can it also develop on other planets, what is the nature of the universal ancestor and how did life evolve from it, and how did intelligent beings such as our audience tonight arise and evolve on Earth? So Ralph, in a short space of an hour, is going to answer all six of those questions in detail for us. So please welcome him here to Monash.
Well, thank you very much. It is a delight for me to be in Australia, a country I've long wanted to visit. My wife and I have just had a great time here. On top of that, we had a four-hour break between our departure and the arrival of our winter's largest snowstorm that blanketed Toronto, and to arrive here in a sunny, warm, open place like this, it's just great. So thank you for the invitation to give this talk this evening. My discussion tonight will be on one of humanity's oldest questions, and it is very simply, are we alone? This has taxed thinkers and everyone on the planet probably since we arrived as species some 200,000 years ago. It's a human question that interests all of us. And particularly in this decade, in our decade now and the decade to come, we are finally equipped with the tools to make progress on answering this question. So it's turned into science from, informed speculation, we say. What has been the transition, really? It's three scientific revolutions listed here. One is the realization in biology and microbiology that There's extreme forms of life on the Earth which are adapted to conditions that would be what we're looking for on other planets. Regions of extreme cold, even colder than Canada. Regions of extreme dryness than your, drier than your deserts. Places like this are places where we find microbes existing. Here, this one existing a few kilometers, 2,800 meters down in rock. The rock has a bit of water in it, in the fractures. Enough chemical energy there to allow this species to survive and grow. The second revolution is an engineering revolution, the exploration of the solar system, and looking for evidence of life, particularly on Mars. And there will be an increasing intensity in this work. We know how to do this. And thirdly, it's the discovery now. I got on the plane, there were 500 planets known. I arrived in Australia, that number's up to 1,700. Reason, the Kepler Observatory made its announcement during my flight. And this is an amazing development that we are only going to be starting to digest in the coming years. So in order to search for life, this life could be quite exotic. We don't know the answer to this. But one thing we can do is we can ask the more mundane question, what is the evidence for life somewhat like we understand? How would we search for life forms that we understand as living? Okay? That we can marshal exploration strategies for. And for life like ours, this mundane, more mundane type, what we do know about our type of life, wherever we find it, is that in order to make complex molecules, something more than water, something that can have information and do interesting things, you need to have carbon around to make long-chain molecules. You apparently also need water. Experimentally, we know that the driest places on Earth are the places with the lowest frequencies of microbes in it, so water seems to be a necessity. But we don't know how life forms would exist in gas giant planets. We don't know if you could assemble something in the atmosphere of Jupiter. But we know for ourselves, a rocky planet is absolutely essential. Minerals like iron are form a very basic part of our own proteins. Okay? So minerals and rocky planets are absolutely important. And then we need energy sources, which are actually quite bountiful in various types of environment on the Earth. So this is kind of a short list of what we would need to search for to have life such as we know it, okay? And I want to make the basic point in this talk from first stars to first life is what's the crucial event that occurred in the universe to start this whole process was the appearance of stars. It is by no means a foregone conclusion that stars have to appear in a cosmology. They happen to appear in ours for several reasons I'm going to talk about. So in our voyage, we're first going to talk about how stars form. This informs our entire discussion. The cycle of stars being born in interstellar gas clouds, stars then evolving, blowing up, sending their elements, the elements like carbon that they make, into the surrounding gas, out of which condense to form planets and other stars. On the surface of the planets, the delivery of things like comets and meteorites that fall inwards, bringing with them water and biomolecules, as we talk about, such amino acids. Processes on the planet that may produce the elements for life are also important things to talk about. So we're first going to talk about stars. We'll then talk about exoplanets, what we know about them, how they arise. And finally, questions, the most major point is, what are the steps, perhaps, to periodic state? So that's our journey tonight, okay? And first I want to talk about stars. Now, stars come in a wide variety of masses, and the most basic thing astronomers try to do with understanding stars is to do a very simple thing, is to make this graph over here and ask how many stars shown up in this axis here, just count them, are there for each massive star? It'd be like counting in this room, I'd say, how many people are age 56? You put up your hands, I put that number. How many are 30, etc.? That's a distribution of ages. This is a distribution that we know of the masses of stars. You see, our own sun, it's number one here, is not the most abundant star around. The most abundant star around is about a tenth the mass of the sun, as it turns out. Okay? But definitely stars peter out here. At a few hundred solar masses, there are no stars anymore, and we don't think there are stars anymore at 10 times the mass of Jupiter, or something like that. This very peculiar distribution of masses seems to be universal. I'm just going to use a few big words here tonight, a log-normal distribution. I'll say that word. I'll tell you what that means in a moment. That's this shape, roughly. Okay. What is crucial about this? What's crucial about it is that the mass of a star strongly controls its environment, for one thing. Here is an example. If we ask, what zone around a star will a planet have liquid water on its surface? If it's too close, the water evaporates. It gets in the high atmosphere, sunlight splits the water, hydrogen gets away, we don't have water, the thing goes into a steam bath. Okay? On the outer side of the habitable zone, carbon dioxide freezes out. The planet simply gets too cold, and you'll have, again, freezing even up carbon dioxide. So shown here, our star is going, here's that lowest mass star, and here up to 10 solar masses, A and B stars. And this region going from a tenth, this is a distance from a star to a planet, so a tenth of the distance from us to the sun, 0.1 astronomical unit to 1. The width of this green band shows you the habitable zone around these different kinds of stars going up in mass. The solar system, Venus is just too hot, Mars is too cold, we're the Goldilocks place. Okay. If you go to more massive stars, that zone is pushed outwards. If you go to a tenth of a solar mass, that zone comes in by a factor of 10. That's where planets have to have liquid water, which, as we said, one of the things we're looking for. Okay? At least liquid water heated by the sun. So, the other thing you want to worry about developing life is how long do they live? Their mass also controls that. So low-mass stars, as an example of the sun, will live about a total of about 10 billion years, comfortable 5 billion more ago or so. Long enough to develop complex life. If it takes a few hundred million years to develop life, we don't know how long that took. There's some indication for that on Earth. So you need, you know, a reasonable mass star to live long enough to do that job. High-mass stars, the ones I showed you up at the end, they may last only a few million years. Even if a planet formed, the star would blow itself to pieces before a planetary system could develop. Okay? So the masses of stars are defining how long you could have a planet there, the habitability zones around it, etc. Very important. Let's continue this journey understanding how stars control this. I will now sort of try to indicate where stars get this range of masses. How is it that we have just that range of masses around? Well, this is the topic of star formation, which is an area of research that's very well represented in Melbourne, in this very university. It's kind of a leading center for this. It's a pleasure to talk to scientists here working on it, who developed, was one example, some of the basic computer codes that we use to study this field. So we make the transition here between diffuse gas between the stars. This is a shot cross-section of the galaxy here, mapped in emission from hot diffuse gas. This is not self-gravitating. This gas could never condense to form stars. It's too hot and diffuse. Here's a downward shot on a nearby galaxy. And you see dust in here. And these are regions where very large self-gravitating piles of gas called molecular clouds, clouds will form. The lit up regions are regions of massive star formation. And you see they trace along where the dense gas is. Okay? In a galaxy. Not always, but by and large they do. I skipped too far. So a lot of amateur astronomers here, you know where the Orion constellation is in your sky. And here's the belt. We're looking at many degrees of sky here. The Orion star is shown here. There's the belt, there's the sword. Tip of the sword is the region of the galaxy about 400 parsecs away where the nearest stars, massive stars, and star cluster is forming.
Ralph, it's upside down.
Sorry? Yeah, I know. I'm still getting used to this. If you had infrared eyes and could see gas emitting light from dust grains, warm dust grains, but stars, this is what your night sky would look like here, okay? As we have emission from all the dusty gas associated with this region. So these belt stars, and especially down here, is a region of strongly concentrated gas, which is churning away, producing a star cluster shown here. This is the wonderful Orion Nebula cluster. Here we see it through infrared eyes, where we can remove, see through the obscuration of the dusty gas in front of it. We have a cluster here, perhaps 1,000 stars will be forming. This is almost a light year across here. We will have thousands of stars being built in such a region like this. Our sun is most likely to have started here. We've likely to have begun as a member of a star cluster, and this is looking somewhat like our birth conditions, our best estimate so far. Okay. What I want to talk about then, about how stars acquire their mass, where they get that from in this gas, is a funny, interesting point. If you do a very nice detailed map using a millimeter wave telescope, where you can, the amount of gas gathered locally is shown here in these dots here. These are concentrations, like raisins, kind of in this filamentary pudding, dense places, where gravity has pulled together enough gas. We know that the stars will be forming in these regions. These are called cores, gas cores. They're a hundredth of, or up to a tenth of a light year across. They're smaller, very small regions. And if we plot the mass distribution of these, that's what we find, that curve here. Now, it looks familiar, doesn't it? That looks a lot like the this functus mass spectrum of stars, which is shown beside it, right here. In fact, you know, if you just reduce this, every mass here by a factor of 3, this curve would more or less slide on top of this one. So we seem to have the start of an answer here, that whatever the physical process is producing these dense regions in this gas, that's what's responsible for producing stars. Gravity kicks in, these regions collapse and condense. But this is the only bit of technical mumbo-jumbo I'm going to show you. If you're all familiar with the bell curve, okay, many teachers have used this to rank us, and professors, we sometimes do the same to our students, but the distributions say, here's the bell curve, or the so-called normal curve, and if you have an additive process, let's play a game of dice. I take two dice and I roll them, okay, and then I decide to add the numbers that I get. So, two dice, the, you know, I have numbers from 2 and 12, average here around 7. The additive process I would have, if I counted the number of times I'd have each result, it would look like a curve like this. Let's play a different game. Let's multiply these numbers. Okay? 1 times 1, or 6 times 6. My numbers now go from 1 to 36, but the distribution of values I get looks like this. This is highly skewed. This is a bell curve of the logarithm. This is a so-called log normal, and it's this curve that is the same as more or less the part of the distribution of stars. Okay. The idea here seems to be that how I get a multiplicative process in gas is to shock it many times. I want to get a piece of gas that's dense. I showed you in those pictures there's lots of shock waves washing around in galaxies from stars that are exploding and spiral waves, etc., pushing gas together. Look at a piece of the galaxy here. It gets slammed by a piece of gas, by a shock wave. It gets denser from that. It gets slammed by another shock wave. It gets denser again. The overall density is the multiplication of all those individual shock waves that hit it randomly. If I take that distribution and plot it, I will have this log normal. So just the basic physics saying that the galaxy's got lots of shock waves shoveling gas together and doing the numbers, as I've just tried to do for you now, will produce a mass distribution for these cores and stars that looks familiar. So the fact that our galaxy is riddled with shocks stirring up the gas and driving this gas into these cores seems to be the origin, or part of the origin, together with gravity, for the distribution of stellar masses, and hence everything that follows from that. So it's comforting to know that there's a basic physical process that we can start handling on our computers that does this. How stars and planets form was first revealed and thought about by these eminent gentlemen right here. The geniuses of centuries gone by, in the 18th century, the observer, William Herschel, who developed key technology, a large telescope, who was the first to look at these nebulae in which stars were forming, and the first to think about what that meant. the Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, very broad-ranging ideas, scientific ideas, actually, who thinking about the Herschel spiral nebulae, wondered whether these might be places where planets might form. And then the brilliant mathematical physicist Laplace, who put together the basic theory for the solar nebula, that planets, stars as we know now too, form out of disks of gas. And basically our results at this point very much validate this Kant-Laplace hypothesis that star formation and planets have to do with disks of gas around stars. This is important because I need to introduce to you how planets form out of this, so we can kind of get on with our topic. So here you see a space telescope picture of a disk seen edge on. You're seeing a very bright background shining at you. You've got an obscuring structure in front of you. Here's another image where you see star, which is buried down in the disk, some of its light getting out and scattering off the walls and coming back at you. But this is wonderful evidence from the Hubble Space Telescope of the existence of disks around stars. We know through numerical calculations now that most of the mass that a star gets comes first by matter falling into a disk and then flowing onto the star. The remnants of that process, the dust grains that settle out of that, in that disk, is the stuff that we make planets out of. So planet formation and star formation are running at the same time in the same object, these protoplanetary disks. So this is getting really good. We can kind of study these at close range now, especially with a new range of instruments coming out called the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, which will be coming online now. First scientific data will be taken next year. I talked about this. Shocks produce both these clumps. It also, the shock waves, as we have two shock waves, collide with one another. That's like an oblique. If you run your hands past one another and kind of an oblique encounter like this, you realize that you could produce a spinning object that way. So these shock waves that are encountering one another also produce the spinning objects. And when a spinning object collapses, it won't collapse to a point, but it collapses to a disk. Okay? So that's where the disks come from. It's part of the same picture. Turbulence driving these shocks will produce spinning cores whose collapse will produce the disks and the planets. So we're developing, you know, a deep scientific idea here that's well supported by observations. I want to show you a simulation that we've done in our group at McMaster University and in collaboration with our collaborators in Heidelberg University, very much in the spirit of some of the work being done here and using codes here developed by Professor Monahan and other collaborators. But this is a calculation in which I'll show you regions that will turn into stars developing in a region like the Orion Cluster. Okay, this is only 100 solar masses, it's not 1,000, but it's a fraction. You see across, so I've got about a half a parsec across. Okay, and you start to see the filaments. We have shock waves running through here. And as the movie develops, you will see bright points develop, which are regions that we know are collapsing into stars. And I'll just let you watch the dynamics that's occurring here. On the top right box, time goes this way, and what you'll see is the individual mass of each particle that appears, you'll see the mass growing. It will tell you the accretion history, how this star is growing as this process occurs. So if everything works here, here is the simulation. And you can see, you will start to see here's the strong filaments developing in this shock medium, okay? Remember the Herschel observations? And here you see our first stars appearing. And you will see that they're appearing along the filaments, okay? Filaments are the place where the gas is the densest, so they should be occurring there. This overall region is going into a state of collapse now. And you see how these protostars are starting to interact with one another dynamically. Over here, the accretion histories, are, you see there's no more gas coming into these. They've leveled out. So after about a few hundred thousand years, basically these stars in this simulation have used up almost 70% of the gas. We know that's too much. Calculation should actually produce about 40. And a star cluster here, which is a tiny Orion, if you wish. It's kind of the state of the art, the kind of things that people in our field are trying to do to recover in detail the how star clusters, the factories, how we get stars in the first place. Now I'm going to switch on you. Now that we think we can produce stars, what about conditions for life? Carbon. This is also associated with the formation of stars, but in a very, very interesting way. So, sorry for this mathematical language. All this is telling you that to make carbon is actually quite simple. You take a helium nucleus, okay, that's two neutrons, two protons, slam that into another one. Then take a third one, slam these together. Then you have the requisite number of protons and neutrons to make the nucleus of carbon, carbon 12. However, on the way, this product of having the two heliums collide and releasing some energy, this beryllium 8 atom, is amazingly unstable. If you didn't know too much more, it's so unstable that in a million of a I can't even say this in words, 10 to the minus 16 seconds, a millionth of a billionth of a second, roughly, this thing would fall apart. You'd get no carbon. Okay? So if you can't produce carbon in the universe, how would you have anything? Interesting. The riddle to this was solved by Fred Hoyle, who I understand did visit Australia and was very important in building up some observational facilities in Australia at the time. Here he's pictured as a young theoretical physicist at work probably solving the problem of how stars make the heavy elements through fusion reactions, through these combinations. And he discovered, he predicted there was a certain kind of things called a resonant phenomenon, a resonant state. I won't go into the details of that. Just there happen to be conditions by which these two heliums can hang around just a little bit longer than he predicted. Long enough so that the third helium can get at it, fuse, and we make carbon. That was his theoretical purpose. There had to be such a state. He computed it, and it was later discovered in nuclear experiments. Okay? A true prediction. If the strength of the nuclear force were different by just a couple of percent, this would be impossible. No carbon, no life like ours. Period. Just by tuning this strength of the nuclear interaction. Okay. We're touching now on an amazing coincidence. The stars are the only place we can make carbon. But even there, it's touch and go that they did. Or that the force strengths are so arranged that they can. There are several ways to try to understand why our universe can do this. In a cosmology talk, I would elaborate on this at length. But one possible solution is that perhaps we are in a universe in which the adjustment of force constants just happens to be right, and things like carbon can be made. Other universes in which this was numbered was 10% different, you only have helium. And you could make stars, but certainly not planets or life by our reckoning. It's not enough to make the carbon. If the carbon stays trapped in the star, it's not useful to get out and to build planets with. We actually have to get it out of the star, so the star has to explode. Okay. Now, here again, low-mass stars do not do this. Our sun will make carbon, but it will not explode carbon in any great abundance into the interstellar medium. The massive stars do precisely this. The end phases of a massive star we were talking about earlier will be in a so-called type 2 supernova explosion, in which the innards of the star are ripped out, and all that carbon and the other elements, like iron that were manufactured there, are pushed into the interstellar medium. Now, this is a really great image. This is a favorite of mine because you can actually see here's a galaxy. There's the telephone book number, dial NGC 6946. You get this guy, and you take an optical image here using a Gemini imaging instrument. Gemini is an 8-meter telescope. And here in this blow up in this box, you see the supernova explosion that's gone off here, and direct measurements of the amount of metal, the amount of dust being produced, the amount of metal being thrown out here, indicates that this one supernova produced a tenth of the solar mass of dust, i.e. stuff like carbon and other things. Okay. So you're watching the process of enrichment in action here. The universe, when stars first appeared on the scene, the only gas around was hydrogen, helium, and a bit of lithium. Everything heavier had to be produced in the interiors of stars. We know that because we can do a bit of archaeology. We can look for poor. When an astronomer talks about metals, for an astronomer, a metal is anything that isn't hydrogen or helium. Okay, they're very simple people. But that helps. So here we can do kind of a chronology. We looked for metal poor stars, and metal poor, we measure the amount of metals in the spectrum of a star. We can do this at a telescope, compare that to the sun. And here, the oldest star known in the galaxy is about 13 gigayears old. And we can use the relative abundance of various isotopes here to kind of put a date on when that star appeared. So we do have an estimate for how old the oldest star is in our galaxy, and it formed just 0.7 billion years after the Big Bang itself. So we were actually able to probe a long way back. This star was very metal poor. Okay. About a thousandth of the metal in the sun, or less. So, asking the question about first stars and what they did to prepare the universe to make planets and life as part of our voyage, here is the diagram often shown, kind of the complete history of the universe. Here we are over here at 13.7 billion years after the Big Bang over here. We see the structure of galaxies, and as we look back in time, in other words, look at fainter and fainter objects with our telescopes, we can look back to a time here. We can look as far back as 400,000 years after the Big Bang in the microwave background radiation, a warm 2.75 degree gas, the emission of protons that we see in all directions. Okay. It's a kind of a baby photograph of the universe at this time. But we're hoping to see to an era where the first stars appear with our new telescopes, the successor to the Hubble telescope, that we can peer to a time about 400 billion years ago, so go the calculations, where out of a dark, cool universe, the first condensation led to the production of the first stars, and hence, when they exploded, the first metals, and hence the very first possibility that life could have occurred. Here are some of the simulations I talk about. They look similar to the kinds of things people do in star formation calculations, with one difference. Here you're seeing density structures building up and as a function of time here. You're seeing gas that's falling into something, the potential wells. The dominant material of a galaxy is dark. We cannot see it. But it defines the gravitational field of a galaxy. It's called dark matter. Gas falls into this and gradually is converted to stars. So the first objects we think formed fell into dark matter wells or halos. There were about a million solar masses. And in this simulation done by Tom et al. A number of years ago, you see as a function of scale here, zooming into a region like the ones I showed you, a tiny fraction of a parsec. Here is an object that we took a million solar masses of gas or say, and here's a region that's condensing rapidly and collapsing to form a 100 solar mass star. Their calculations suggest first objects might be 100 solar masses. That will go supernova very quickly, and the first metals in the universe will be produced at that time. So we've gone back to first stars. How do we connect planets with this? Why did I hopefully not bore you with this? Talking here about our next major scientific revolution, since 1995, over 500 exoplanets were discovered by a so-called Doppler wobble method. If I've got a massive planet in orbit, say Jupiter around our sun, okay, Newton showed that the solution for this problem, the gravitational problem, is that both objects orbit their common center of mass. That's how a gravitating system of two planets, a star and a planet, works.
G'day, this is Dr. Carl. You're listening to Brains Matter, and they do.
So the sun is actually, our sun is actually also orbiting around the common center. And if we were far away looking at our sun, you would see that motion of the sun, okay? As the star approaches you, the light from it is so-called blue-shifted. As it moves away, it's red-shifted. So astronomers can pick up that effect. The kind of speed we're talking about, that we have to resolve velocities of motion is about a little as 1 meter per second, 3 meters per second. That's how sensitive your telescope spectroscopy has to be to catch the fact of a star walking, okay, towards you. That's the Doppler shift you're measuring. Okay. A brilliant revolution in science that opened up this whole window. I'm very happy to say that in my alma mater, UBC, Professor Walker was one of the first to develop the instrumentation technique to develop this that was later slightly adapted and used by the subsequent teams that made the discoveries. Other way of detecting planets is this observatory. Who here has heard of Kepler? Okay. Great. So you're well attuned to what's going on. You're living in a major revolution right now. Tell your grandkids. That you're living in this moment, because it's very important. We've now found 1,200 planets by another method. Is if we take the disk of a star here, and I have a planet orbiting around it, at the point where the planet comes between you and the star, I absorb the light from this. Okay. So the overall light from the star drops, because it's being obscured by the planet. Then it moves away and you see the star again. So that regular blip of light as a planet comes around can be detected, and by this telescope on board the Kepler Observatory, and by staring at a sample of over 100,000 stars, has so far detected the potential 1,200 exoplanets. What's important for our story, conditions for life, is that some of these, at least 70 of these planets, are down around the Earth mass range, or less. And that, moreover, 54 of these planets are in the habitable zones around their stars. So if they have water, that water would be liquid. This is astonishing. 200 of these systems have multi-planets. So it's not just individual, whole planetary systems out there. And so we've just opened an incredible wealth, things we'll be thinking about for years to come. Now, here's a crucial plot, another crucial graph for you. I think one of the greatest discoveries about planets around stars is how much metal has to be out there to make a planet. Okay. So what this plot shows is we look at a star and measure its spectrum, and we can say, oh, this star's got so much metal. We expect the gas around it to have that same amount of metal that it started, okay? Probably a fraction. So we can say that we now look for, does that star with some metal, does it have a planet around it or not? Let's plot the number of stars that we see with the metallicity relative to the sun. So here are stars relative to the sun with these old surveys, about 10% of them had planets. But if you come to a star here that only a third of the metal of the sun, or a tenth, you don't find planets. It appears to be that you have to have a minimum amount of metal-enriched gas then before you can form planets at all in the universe. This is really interesting. Because remember I told you that cosmic gas after the Big Bang doesn't have any metal in it. The amount of metallicity in the gas is just the sum total of taking generation after generation of supernova. It's contributing metal to the medium. The next star forms, adds to that. It's a cumulative process as we go through cosmic time. So there is a interesting plot here put together by Professor Lyon Mew at Mount Stromlo ANU, where I'll be visiting next week, that did the following very interesting calculation. Take that graph I had before and say, okay, I need at least 10th of the middle of the sun in order to form a planet, okay? How long does that take? I'm living in a certain part of the galaxy. We live at about this radius, about 8,000 parsecs from the center. Here's time going this way. Here's the current moment. We go back 2, 4, 6, 8 billion years ago. Here's 4 billion years ago. Our sun, our planet is about 4.5 billion years ago. And here we ask ourselves the question, when is that galaxy rich enough in metals to reach a 10th solar? All right, everybody with me? It takes about 8 billion years to put enough metal in our part of the galaxy together to have enough stuff to make the planets out of. In other words, our planet appeared here almost as soon as it could. I mean, life occurred here as soon as it could, as soon as you had enough material to assemble a planet. Okay. So this is the idea of the galactic habitable zone. How long does it take you in a galaxy, here's the sun shown here, to reach the conditions where you've got sufficient metal to make a rocky planet? I am not going to take you through the details of planet building. I think I'm going to move on to the next question about supplying our planet with water. The slide I just skipped over told you a little bit how we build planets. We build planets by taking smaller pieces, planetesimals, about 100 kilometer sized bodies, and slamming them together. Okay. Many simulations have been done over time. So it's a kind of a core accretion model, the idea of planets strike one another, 100 kilometer body builds something larger, larger yet, a few run away. If they run away enough so you get 10 Earth masses worth, that's the core of a Jupiter. Jupiter brings gas down onto it. We get a Jupiter appearing. Our Earth appears, here's a plot here showing the place we are in the disk of a young disk. The temperature of the disk of gas varies as we go outwards. It gets hot in the middle, cooler as we go away. At some point far out of the disk, we get it cold enough so that we can have a Canada, a place where it snows. Inside of that is Australia. You don't know what snow is. Okay. That's a dry place, because the water can't condense. Okay. The place where it starts snowing, you could call it the Canada line, but it's actually called the snow line. Okay. After that, water can condense out of the gas, and we would have wet materials, okay? Ice will be lined. So now, if the Earth formed at one estimate of where it is, it would have been Australia. There would be no water on it. So our oceans are here because water was brought to the Earth. It was brought by, would have been brought by, planetesimals that are wet enough from beyond the snow line, from orbits beyond Mars. They get here because Jupiter is this big giant, gravitationally in the solar system, and it shakes up the orbits of disks of planetesimals and puts them into more and more eccentric orbits. Like comets do, they visit the interior part of the solar system. They collide with the planets there, and they bring water. That's what this calculation shows you. 1 million years, start with a bunch of wet asteroids here and dry ones over here, shake it up with a Jupiter here, and then at the end of the day, this is showing the eccentricity of the orbits. I don't want to get into technical things, but at the end of the day, you end up, the color indicates the water content. You collide all these together. You do get a system with about 5 terrestrial planets. That's good. And then we can say how much water is in them. And here's the result. This curve shows you that the typical result of these calculations is that a planet would have 10 Earth oceans worth of water. There are a few planets that would have less than an Earth ocean, and some are amazing water worlds that may have 300 Earth oceans worth. So there's lots of water in these gaseous disks, and typically, we should expect pretty wet planets. In fact, there's an interesting question. Why is our Earth so dry? geophysicists answer that is probably that there's about 7 Earth oceans worth of water in the interior, tied up in the mantle, that we're not seeing. Okay. So we've talked about how we get rock, how we get water, metallicity, when stars should form, when planets should form. Let's go on to first life. Our modern ideas of how life appeared on planets is due to these two gentlemen shown here. J.B.S. Holding, kind of an Oxford professor. You can see what part of the 20th century he must have been working in. Okay. A real maverick. And his Soviet counterpart here, A.I. Parent, who wrote this a very important book, The Origins of Life. And what these two gentlemen did between them is break open the idea that life, when it develops on a planet, develops really only once. Not continuously, the way the older ideas had. Life could form in a dirty rag, you know, in the older ideas, the pre-20th century ideas. The conditions for life were determined by some sort of a primordial hot soup, a mixture of the right chemicals, that under some circumstances somehow could spark the formation of more complex structures. That the basic origin of life, therefore, is a combination of the basic laws of chemistry, how such atoms would interact and work in such a soup, together with Darwin's law of evolution, that complex that has an advantage. It can maybe eat other organic molecules around or propagate itself more efficiently, would gradually take the soup over. These two ideas are the center of our thinking currently of how life originated. We don't have the answer to this yet, by any means. So for the moment, it's an informed hypothesis. But let's see how far we go down this road. Here's kind of a sketch of the early life of Earth. We've just learned why the formation of Earth was about 4.5 billion years ago. It's the earliest that could have occurred. That's here on this timeline. And over here at 3.5 billion years ago, we have evidence for first DNA that the genetic code as we have it originated long ago. That was already decided about 3.5 billion years ago. It's this intermediate, this prebiotic chemistry here. It's the organization of the simpler molecules, organic things like amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, and the building blocks of things like DNA or RNA that led to the formation of more complex structure. It's this that we don't understand right in here. We're chewing away at this from both ends. This is a picture of what on Earth, at least, was like at that time. A dominant ocean, there were no continents. Continents hadn't risen up yet. So there are a few volcanic-driven islands in this picture. And we've got volcanoes spewing forth N2, nitrogen, carbon dioxide. These are places where lots of electricity runs through. We know these kind of thunderclouds exist here. It's sources of energy that can drive chemistry. There are a few freshwater ponds on these isolated islands. There's lots of energy available from light and thermal energy. And I give you this. So here's an undergraduate physics problem. Solve this, show that life pops up here. Pretty hard to do. These are the ingredients everybody talks about, however. And that seems, we have pretty good evidence from geophysical and chemical sides that this is a decent picture, at least of the initial conditions on our Earth, at the time we think life got started. I now want to focus on the biomolecules. How did we prepare that prebiotic soup, that mix that had amino acids in it that could make proteins? Actually, the interesting thing is that this too, the amino acids that we have, that we have 20 amino acids in every protein in your body, 10 of those were prebiotic, they don't need an organism to make them. And we know from measurements of meteorites that fall to the Earth that we can find amino acids in here. Okay? This one Australia is famous for many reasons, and one of them is right here, the famous Murchison meteorite. Everybody that studies this topic uses data on the meteorite here that fell in Australia, which is a very rich source of amino acids and all kinds of compounds that are important for basic biochemistry. So these are clearly made in interstellar, interplanetary space. Here's the idea how we think this happens. A meteorite is a chip off this planetesimal, all these collisions. And planetesimals, here's the interior cutaway view of a planetesimal. It can get to a temperature of 140 degrees centigrade in its interior. Its water will melt for a few hundred million years. And turns out this is a nice chemical place to develop chemical reactions leading to amino acids. We're actually computing such models right now. So you break off chips of this, and this is presumably where the meteorites got their amino acids. They fall to the planet, bring the biomolecules with them. We know that at least half of perhaps the organic carbon that fell to the Earth, in the Earth, comes from meteorites. It's still showering this material on us today. Here's another measured way that amino acids have been found in interstellar space. This is an actual experiment. Take a comet flying through a solar system, this one right here, Wild 2. You take the spacecraft, Stardust Observatory, fly it through the tail, collect the dust grains that are coming spewing off of the tail of the comet. These dust grains, icy dust grains, bring that back to the Earth. And measure if you find trapped in this gel that you used to capture, what do you find there? And in this paper here, 2009, was announced the discovery of the simplest amino acid, glycine. I show you what an amino acid is here. I don't want to tax your chemistry. I'm not such a great chemist myself. But an amino acid basically is this thing. It's got this amino group. That's where it gets its name. Two hydrogens and a nitrogen. Okay? And it's got this bit of organic chem here. A carbon, two oxygens, and a hydrogen. These two things are common to every amino acid. And the rest is an add-on, R here. Right. Of the many dozens of amino acids available in nature, life chose to start with 10. We don't know why, but it did. How else do we get amino acids? I focus on amino acids, by the way, because we can measure them. They are preserved. We can see them in meteorites. And they're an important part of any living system by building in proteins. So it's a great thing to focus your thinking about. This is the experiment by Miller and Urey that started the field in 1953, the Miller-Urey experiment, in which you take a flask here. This is a model for a kind of an ocean boiling away, hydrogen vapor. Here's our electrical discharge going on. The vapor that you put in here is a combination of water as well as gases, which are like the gases you'd find in Jupiter in these early experiments. And at the end of the day, you collect down this vessel amino acids. Actually, if you're interested in cooking, making a primordial soup, you can look on YouTube for a Julia Child's segment, which is cooking a probiotic soup. And she makes it in her kitchen. I highly recommend it. She gets her science just right. So this is a way that you can cook amino acids. We now know that the mixture of gases Miller used was not quite the right one. But it is a way. And thirdly, another place is where we think that you could form the conditions for life, which I personally, I'm a bit skeptical about, but at the mid-ocean trenches in which you've got plates pulling apart and you have volcanoes spewing out material into the water, this is a place with very rich chemistry as possible. Hot water enriched with stuff from underneath. You can get chemical reactions to occur here. And some of the simplest bacterial life forms are very happy in such an environment. They greedily eat this stuff. These are the three places that we think you can form are the first amino acids, the first environments in which life may have been possible. If you grind off a piece of the Murchison's meteorite, moreover, there's things like fatty acids in these meteorites, and if you suspend that in water, you get these little bags here. We think that life needs cells
little compartments in which you can have reactions. Well, if you just grind up Murchison, you will have that. Now, these are smaller than cells. These are simple lipids. And what a fatty molecule does, as you know, it doesn't like water very much. And so here's the kind of shows you a layer of such fatty acids lining up and creating kind of a membrane here. Okay, the water-loving and water-disliking ends of these form these bilayers, so-called, but you can create a membrane out of this. So we seem to have a lot of the basic components available, even to coming from us from outer space. I'd like to go now a little bit to our personal work I've been involved in, and take this one more step and ask the basic question. We see amino acids being produced in various environments. And the question that my collaborator, biophysicist McMaster, and myself asked ourselves was, what would determine the relative amounts of each kind of amino acid that we know is important for life? We can take the data from all these experiments. I'm not going to go in detail, look at dusting grains from space, atmospheric chemistry experiments, from observed meteorite data, like Murchison, collect all this data and ask the simple question, how many of each kind of amino acid do we find? The relative frequency of these. Is that mirrored in the frequency of amino acids we see in living things, or not? So we found that you could divide the amino acids. Life has 20 of them. Turns out 10 of them, as I mentioned before, called the early type, are found non-biologically. The other 10 have to be made by living organism. For chemistry fans, if you're not, just turn away. If you're interested, here is a set of what amino acids look like, their chemical structure. I told you they always have this carboxyl group and the amino acid group. They divide in different physical properties, from amino acids that hate water to ones that like water. Amino acids are probably chosen because they have a variety of physical properties in making proteins. And I won't belabor the ones the other set. But here is an astonishing result that we found when we put together the data and asked ourselves a simple question. Is the amount of amino acid present related somehow to the amount of energy that you need to form it? That's this energy down here. That's this graph. How much energy you need to make the molecule under some circumstance, kind of average pressure, reasonable temperature, and how much do you get relative to glycine? So these are the 10 amino acids. And this line through the data is a fit telling you that the simple point is that thermodynamics is controlling this answer. That basically the abundance of each amino acid in these very different situations is always determined by how much energy you needed to make it. Now this would presumably be universal. It wouldn't just be here on the Earth. This is a basic piece of thermodynamics. So any primordial soup in which you're trying to cook cells, make things, as long as it was kind of in reasonable conditions, I can't say that this is universal, but it's reasonable. Water is aqueous here. It's at a modest temperature. Under these conditions, the building blocks of proteins, the relative frequency of our building materials, should be more or less similar. So there may be something universal to this. My last couple of slides, I'm going to get into speculation, but it's informed speculation. The genetic code between DNA and protein is very complex. It's far too complex for the first organism that was around to have developed something so complicated as DNA protein. And I think you all know what I mean by that code. Something simpler must have been there to begin with, but at the moment where you make a genetic code is an arrangement where you take our four bases, constituents of the DNA molecule, And they code for protein. That's what a code is, for amino acid. There are 64 possible combinations of our four letters. That's this table, okay? And then there's 20 amino acids. Now just lump your amino acids together with any of these four variables, and this is what it means. This is the genetic code in front of you. That's what it means. Life evolved this in about 500 million years. And then stuck with it. Here's glycine. All these combinations of these bases here are coding. They line up, they take a glycine, and then that glycine gets hooked into the into the protein that's building with this is the code. Okay. So the more speculative point that we make in this is as follows. That early on, remember, we only had 10 simple amino acids, and those amino acids, well, life chose those. Sorry, take that back. The amino acids that were present, the frequencies of the amino acid, how often you could find something simple like glycine, must have had some role in the genetic code. There's a developing theory of this, actually. You could take proteins and make simpler proteins. You know, put them just with fewer amino acids. You can still have functional operating proteins, enzymes that can catalyze reactions. We know that. So the idea is here that the amount of amino acids of different kinds available probably did some conditioning of how the early code developed. If that's so, then even a genetic code, if it became like a DNA protein code, if that happened, we don't know at all if that's typical, but if it is, may also have some general properties. As things evolve from the simplest part version of the code, the idea is that you could substitute, you could take amino acid with similar properties, and you'd slightly change the code by swapping in amino acid similar into the code for another one, and gradually increase your functionality, the expressiveness of your code, its ability to build finer and finer tools and enzymes. Okay. So we think that this calculation isn't just frivolous, that perhaps there is something that's conditioning of the code by the materials that are available. So I just want to end. First of all, you can buy our book. It's the conference proceedings put together, an astrobiology conference we ran at our institute a number of years ago. If you're interested in this topic, there are a number of good sources you can go to, including ours, slightly more technical here. But there's an excellent literature going on these problems. Summary is that star formation, as I tried to show you, controls many aspects of the origin of life in the universe. It controls it in a lot of ways. Making the biomolecule, making the rock, making the water, how planets are developed, so all of it is controlled by stars. It may even control the amount of amino acids, etc., that are delivered to plants. So astrophysics has a big role to play in this question of the origin of life. It may be also that this prebiotic soups we're talking about may, following Maparin and Haldane, have certain basic characteristics that maybe will help us understand why life began there. Whatever the answer to this question, we certainly are developing the abilities, the technical capabilities, to start really attacking these questions by our follow-up to the Kepler observations, astronomy, taking spectra of planets, our 30-meter telescope that we'd like to build, part of in Canada, as an example, with other international collaborators, ExoMars rover expeditions. This is a great field, and one with a great future. Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoy that talk. I'd like to thank Ralph Woodruff, Ali Ford, Daniel Price, and Duncan Galloway to help this recording happen. I'll leave you with a quote from Buckminster Fuller. Nature is trying very hard to make us succeed, but nature does not depend on us. We are not the only experiment. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right-hand side. You can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email. All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now.